This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hi, this is John with a quick announcement. Our friend James Avery over at the Lounge Network has been working on setting up podcast sponsorships, and he has asked us to help plug a very short survey. It's at tinyurl.com/loungepodcastsurvey. You can win all 41 Manning in Action books. They're giving away two sets of that, and then also giving away a $100 gift certificate to something or other. So go do it. Okay, bye. Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This week we're going to talk briefly about some funny mistakes we've made over the years, and then we're going to talk about the news and all the mistakes everyone else is making. So I'll start. I worked on one of my first things I did at this company was I was brought in to work on this search system for their website, and it spidered the website, and everything worked well in the little tests that we did and stuff. And then the next, you know, I went home at night, everything's running, and did this overnight process. Come in the next day, and all hell has broken loose. And it turns out that the search site was spidering the entire website, including the page with the search results. And so it was like recursively searching itself and growing bigger and bigger. And, you know, so like it would search the website, and then it would hit the search page, which had the most common searches, and then it would spider into those, and it was just insanely recursive. That was a silly little thing I did. Anyone ever sent emails to somebody they shouldn't have?
No. Oh, wait, I have.
Anyone ever sent too many emails to someone that they shouldn't have?
That's like my stock in trade, sending too many emails. So the one time I was tasked with writing a mass emailer for a marketing boss I had, and it wasn't quite spam, because the people who had signed up for it had said, you know, send me more information by email. So, you know, rather than, you know, pay some, you know, write some virus to do this for us and, you know, dead servers in China or something, we wrote a little Outlook add-in that would allow her to compile the email and add everyone to the distribution list from an Excel spreadsheet and send it off. And just to make sure that she knew that the emails got sent off, I made sure to include her email on the CC line. And there's about 10,000 emails or so in the spreadsheet. So I hit, you know, send on this little Outlook add-in, and it dutifully started iterating over the email addresses in the spreadsheet and sending off emails to each and every one. And then pretty soon I get this, you know, my phone rings and I get this call. She says, something has gone horribly wrong. And I can hear the Outlook, you know, new email sound just constantly going in the background over the phone. And that's when I realized that I was sending her all 10,000 emails. And then we all laughed. And I did not get fired. And then there was one other time where this was back in the VB6 classic ASP days, you know, where you would tie into that, I can't even remember now, but the MTS server or the objects, and you would get a hold of request and response, so you could, you know, write a little VB6 DLL that would actually handle all the web interactions and stuff. I think this was back in the Microsoft DNA days, back when NTIER was called DNA. Anyone remember that? I know K-Scott does. And John, probably
I do.
So dutifully, you know, we had our on-air go to
DNA anymore. Hang on.
Now it's NDA. I think you're mixing
that
up.
NDA. That could be. We can't talk about it. We can just implement the pattern. It's the I think it's called the provider manager factory pattern instead of DNA.
Domain specific provider pattern.
Domain-driven pattern, factory pattern, practice view, manager,
view model,
supervisor, controller, view model. Yes. So we were dutifully, you know, we had our on-air, you know, go to this function, yada yada, set up, and we decided that it'd be a good idea if we, you know, threw an exception in our app that, you know, we should tell someone about it. So we decided we were going to send emails to a list of people who could take care of it. You know, and one of those people happened to be the CTO. And at the time I was working on this contract at a Fortune 500 company. And so we had, you know, like the CTO on the list, and we had a sysadmin distro list and everything on this list of people we were sending the emails to. And just happened that our app was an intranet app, and it was basically the homepage. And the homepage would make some database connections to get some, you know, the latest news and calendars and whatnot. And then, so what happened was the database server, the SQL servers, went offline. They failed. So that meant that every time that the homepage on this intranet loaded, we would log an exception and send off an email to this distro list. Well, there's about 80,000 people in this company, kind of spread over the world. So we got, you know, a couple of emails from the offices when you know, they logged on in Germany. You know, not enough to really, you know, we'd see it and we go, oh, well, yeah, that seems odd, but then we wouldn't see anymore. But it was like 3 in the morning. And so then at starting at like 5 a.m., the people on the East Coast started logging in. And every time they would go to the homepage, boom, an email would get sent. And then you could tell when people got to work, because you would suddenly get this deluge of emails. And this was back in the day when, you know, the Exchange inbox limit was like, you know, 40 or 50 megabytes. That was considered huge. So we all hit our limit pretty quick. You know, about the time we hit the central standard time, because we were, of course, emailing the entire stack trace.
Okay, Scott, have you ever made a mistake?
I was just thinking that a lot of my mistakes have been hardware related. I mean, I've certainly made software mistakes too, but the couple of things that stand out in my mind are, my first job out of college was with a defense contractor on an army base in Pennsylvania, and they gave me permission to rearrange my cubicle. And I was so happy about that. But in the process, I decided to take a shortcut and just temporarily stack my monitor on top of something while I moved a wall or something. And I knocked over that monitor and it broke into 1,000 pieces on the floor. And I'm sure, you know, the Army or someone paid like $10,000 for that monitor. I thought I was going to be whipped or beaten or whatever they do on military bases when people break things. John would probably know. But the other time I was impatient was the job after that. I was doing some embedded systems programming, and I don't remember why, but I had to open my PC for something. So I took the case off, jiggled something or installed something, wanted to test it, so I booted up the PC. Everything was working, and I didn't want to shut it down and reboot it, because, you know, those were the days when computers took a long time to boot up, as opposed to now with Vista, when they take a really long time to boot up. But I thought, maybe I'll just take the cover and put it back on the computer while it's running and then just keep working. So I get the cover on the computer and something's not quite fitting, so I'm like hammering it down. And the next thing I know, everything blue screens or something goes crazy. And I look, and there I just severed through the power connector for the hard drive, which, once we got it connected back up, we couldn't recover any of the source code on it. And it had all the source code of stuff I had worked on for like a couple months. So we had to send it out to a disaster recovery company.
Oh, no.
If I remember, I think they actually did get things off of it, but I felt really bad. And ever since then, I learned my lesson. I never put a cover back on a computer without turning it off first. It's a lesson for you kids who are listening.
I worked, this isn't directly military, but I worked at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and I was kind of bored. They had me, I'm not sure, they had me kind of in the wrong division. I was working in this experimental nuclear lab, which sounds interesting, but it wasn't really all that neat. And I like carried around pieces of uranium sometimes and stuff. But one time I was bored. I shared this room with these two other guys, and we goofed around on computers. And one day I got time on the Cray, like one of the Crays that was running there. And I was like, oh, this is cool. You know, I'll run a simulation. And I did this, you know, simulating fission, which, you know, like chain reaction kind of thing. And of course, like it did exactly what it was supposed to do. And it went wildly out of control. And I shut down the Cray. And I did not get any more Cray time the rest of the stay there at Los Alamos. So...
You crashed a supercomputer?
I sure did. And I'd do it again, too. Has anyone ever... I have been very, very lucky. I've never dropped a database and lost information that couldn't be recovered, but I've gotten very close many times. Like, you know, the old where, like, in Query Analyzer or SQL Server Management Studio or whatever it is, you know, where you say delete... from users where user ID equals blah, 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 and then you select delete from users and hit F5, you know, and wipe out the entire user table. And I've done that kind of thing on a stage server and been able to recover the data. I don't run queries on on production data much anymore, which is probably why I stay out of that trouble, but I've gotten pretty close several times. Anyone ever lost any data that was a problem?
Not through Query Analyzer.
Yeah, I don't think I've never. I have accidentally dropped, you know, the wrong table or too much database. There are too much data out of a database or a table. You know, deleted too much. But I've always, you know, I think I did that once, and after that, I just got so paranoid that I'm just, you know, back up right before I do anything. I'm going to do a select. Oh, I'm going to make a backup.
Yeah.
And I just back up the entire hard drive. But for a long, long time, and still, I think my nemesis was the ADO record set dot move next method.
Yes.
I've crashed more than one server, you know, by forgetting to put that inside of the loop.
One thing I did many, many, many years ago was, God, I don't even remember when this was, but it was when OS 2 2.0 first came out in beta. Does anybody remember this time? An eon ago. And I was, you know, this was like desk view was the hot thing. And so, you know, OS 2 2.0 had this killer like multitasking. And so I decided I was going to install it on my machine, my main machine, my only machine really. And, you know, I had no backups of any kind. And the installer, I don't know exactly what happened. I don't remember. But the installer totally munged the boot record on my machine, and I was like completely flipping out. So me and a friend of mine went through with, I don't remember what tool it was, like booted off a floppy. It was some like byte level disk editor, and like reconstructed the FAT table like by hand. You know, like figuring out where all the file pointers were, and like, you know, it took hours. But we actually did it. I was actually kind of astonished, but we basically manually reconstructed the first part of the FAT table.
I've got a lot of respect for you, Kevin, because you were able to tell a story that's in the mistake theme, but you were able to show off that you reconstructed a FAT table. That's well done, like one of those sir.
Apologies is not apology.
Right.
I think it was really mostly my friend who like figured it out. And I was sitting there like freaking out, entering whatever he told me to enter. So, I didn't think
so, so what are some of your weaknesses, Kevin? Right. God, you know, I'm just so often that I make other people feel bad.
I'm too detail oriented.
I work too hard.
Okay, here's another one for you then. So there was a time I used to work in QA, and I sort of ran a big QA lab. And we had a Novell directory services, whatever they called them, directory tree, you know. I don't remember what the term they used was for our lab that everybody used as sort of their primary login. And I ran the server and was monkeying around in the services manager and essentially deleted the entire directory tree, like from the root.
Oh.
The good news was I had a backup. The bad news was I couldn't get the backup to restore. The backup tool would always like get, you know, it was one of those, it's like the restore runs for an hour And then when it's 90% done, it bombs out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at this point, like, after several attempts, you know, it's the middle of the night, and I'm flipping out trying to get this thing to restore, and it's one of those, oh, maybe if I try it again, it'll somehow magically work for some stupid reason that it, you know, because of course it's not going to work again. And I finally left at, like, I think it was, I stayed all night until the next morning and gave up and was like, oh, sorry, guys, you're not going to be able to log in. And then I talked to the backup people who make the backup software the next day, and it turns out I was missing some, you know, fix from Novell for whatever the hell, you know, some NLM fix that I didn't have that was totally breaking the backup software. So that was one of those all-nighter attempts to recovery that just crashed and burned.
I had one thing I did once, which was just, it wasn't a big change, but it was a, we had a service at a financial company, and it was like it was a redirector. Like, so it basically was kind of like a central hub where you would, I forget what it was, you would log in one place and it would redirect your links to other places, you know? So that allowed one application to link to a consistent ID, and then the other applications could change around no matter how they wanted, and you know, we'd sort that out. And I made some kind of change and didn't test it thoroughly enough and pushed it out at, you know, 5 p.m. and, you know, did some little tests that I thought worked and then went home. And then the next morning I came in and, like, you know, there's like the company VPs and all these people standing outside my little cubicle. You know, it wasn't a huge change, but it was just strategically placed so that it made it so, like, all the apps went down. I was just like, oh, man. And fortunately, I really had nothing good to say about it. I screwed up. But, I mean, I'd done enough good stuff over the past year or whatever that they were like, okay, well, don't do it again. But that was a bummer.
Okay, I have a fairly recent hardware disaster, where not disaster, but kind of error, where I had taken an extra 80 gig hard drive out of an old TiVo and was going to sort of repurpose it for, I don't know, like offsite backups or something. And, you know, it's an old drive. It's not something that's that valuable or anything. But so I'd got one of those USB drive connectors where you actually attach it to sort of the bare drive that doesn't actually have a case. You just plug it, the power jack and the cable directly to the drive. And I was just going to, you know, wipe the drive and copy some stuff onto it. And I still don't know how I did it, because it shouldn't really even be possible, but I managed to plug the power connector in backwards.
I've done that.
And so I...
Did you just muscle it in, or...?
No, I'm sorry. I take it back. It wasn't the power connector. It was the data connector. It was able to get in backwards. Like, for, you know, usually those, the pin set is sort of keyed, so it won't let you put the thing in upside down, but maybe there was something weird about this drive. I don't know. But, you know, it let me do it, and I plugged the thing in, and there was literally a puff of smoke that came up off the drive. And you could actually see the smoke kind of go, like, drift up from the drive.
Oh.
It went bye-bye.
The magic smoke. Back in the old days, when you actually had to push the cache RAM and install it onto your motherboards, or worse, you know, one of those big, long memory cards. And you remember you had to put the little dimple in facing the right way. And if you put it in backwards, you let the magic smoke out of the chip. I've done that more than once back then. And I blew up a power supply once. That was surprising.
I hate hardware.
I don't remember.
Pretty much anything to do with like software, you can undo it, you can restore it, you can recreate it, but when hardware blows up, you're just screwed, you know? And the stupid things, like, that shouldn't be possible, like, Kevin, what you were saying, I one day I was over at my brother's house a long time ago, and it was New Year's Day, and I stopped in and was checking on something. I was like, hey, you know, I forget what it was. I can tweak your computer to make it better, which is stupid, because his computer was just fine. But I ended up, like, flipping something around, and I unplugged floppy drive. I unplugged a drive IDE cable and put it in upside down, and it was the same thing. I don't know why it lets you do that, but it worked, except then the computer wouldn't boot. And I tried all kinds of things and could not figure it out, and I spent my entire New Year's Day troubleshooting the stupid hardware thing. Finally called somebody up that was like, oh, you probably flipped over your cable, and that was it. But I just hate hardware.
That reminds me of another hardware one, actually, where I had a family member of a friend of mine actually had a small, you know, office and needed some sort of networky sort of, you know, help. And this was out of town. This was like in Atlanta, I think it was. And so I actually flew out there. They flew me out there to do some work on their network. And what they were having a problem with a tape drive, like a tape backup drive. And it was getting weird errors in the event log. So I went in there and looked, and the dip switches weren't set right. The SCSI stuff wasn't configured right. And so I fixed it, quote unquote, so I thought. And it was working fine when I was there. I tested it and then, you know, did all the rest of the stuff on the network and then flew home. And as far as I knew, everything was fine. And it was like a couple weeks later, I end up getting a call from these guys saying, we've been trying to reach you. We've left you messages. You know, where have you been? It turns out just by chance, my answering machine had been getting really flaky lately. So it was like not recording messages, but you know, I didn't realize that at the time. And so as far as they just think that I'm dodging their call because like their server is crashing every day and something's, you know, completely messed up, you know, having to do with my quote unquote fixes with the SCSI drive or the SCSI tape drive. So I didn't feel too good about how I came off, and I totally feel like I'm trying to dodge their calls or something, even though it was totally just due to my flaky answering machine that I had missed their call.
Are we out of good mistakes?
Never sleep with your client.
Yeah, that sounds like interesting story.
Alrighty.
Yeah. So, is that the end of that one?
Can't hear you. You're breaking up.
I'll type it in the chat window.
John, you could talk about the time we did a whole show and turned out you didn't record it.
Oh, yeah, we could talk about which time is that?
Actually, I was going to say, or all the times that's happened.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a bummer, too, because it's like, yeah. I mean, it sucks if it's the three of us. It sucks even worse if it affects somebody that's on the show. And it's just, yeah, it's, yeah.
And they're drunk. And it's late.
And there's no way to, get the information back either. I mean, I'm not very obsessive. I'm actually pretty sloppy about a lot of things I do with computers. But the one thing that I'm hugely obsessive about is like backups to stuff. Like I run TimeSnapper on every computer. I make sure previous versions is enabled. I do all kinds of stuff so that like if I lose, you know, I make sure things are checked into Subversion or some sort of source control. And, you know, it's all just so that I don't lose anything, you know. And maybe that's being a pack rat, but it's like I love being able to say, oh, you know, fine, my computer shut off, but, you know, I can dig that information up. But it's so for that reason, it just sucks even more when we, like, the recording gets screwed up, we lose a show, and then it's just gone, you know. So that's part of why that I worked with the people that make the recording system that we use for our show, Callgraph. And I talked to them and got them to put in, I think they had other feedback on that too, but I got them to put in recording indicators that show speaker and microphone like activity. So I can see that it's being recorded. I can watch the bytes being written to disk and all that, just because I'm like, I don't want that to happen again, you know?
Did I ever tell you my ATM story? It's not really a mistake though.
Sounds like a good story, as long as it ends with you sleeping with the client.
No. But the funny thing about this story was it was during the internet boom days, and I was working for a startup, and we just had these venture capitalists in who insisted that we use some sort of transaction server in our architecture. and no one knew, had any idea what a transaction server was or how it could help us, but we were determined to get it into the product. But I remember having this meeting right before lunch about where some goofball stood up and said, "And what is a transaction anyway? Well, here are the atomic properties of a transaction, blah, blah, blah." Anyway, I walked out of that meeting kind of hungry. I didn't have any money, so I walked down the street to an ATM machine, and this is a little bank. This startup was in a small town that was a college town. It was kind of an interesting place. Anyway, walk up to the ATM, put in my card, punch in the PIN, everything. I can hear it counting the money when all of a sudden, pop! It's like the transformer on the pole just blows and everything goes black and the ATM shuts off. And I stood there for a while wondering what to do, hoping that, well, maybe it would spit out money at some point. And it boots up into OS 2. So Kevin's story made me think about this. That was the first time I had ever seen OS 2 on an ATM machine, but apparently that's relatively popular. And it boots back up and just comes to its normal screen, and I never got any money. I figure, well, that's okay. I'm sure they have transactions. They're a big bank. You know, ATM never signaled that it actually dispensed the money, so I should still have it in my account. Well, like a month later when I'm balancing my checkbook, I realized they actually did take $40 out of my account or whatever it was. And so I went to the bank the next day, and I walk in, and I thought, you know, I'm going to tell them the story, and they're just going to think I'm nuts, right? I tried to get your money out of your ATM, and it ripped me off. But I walk up to the teller, and I say, I was here about 3 weeks ago, and I tried to withdraw $40, and she just stops me and says, "Wait, I know someone that wants to talk to you." Well, apparently, some poor woman in the back of this bank had been slaving over books for hours or days, I don't know, but she comes running out and says, "You're missing $40? I said, "Yes." And she's so excited. She had worked at the bank for 10 years and had never seen this happen before. And she made me tell her the story, and she happily gave me my money. And she just had never had a problem balancing the books on the ATM machine before. And it was driving her nuts where this $40 went to. The end.
Nice.
It was a happy ending. I don't think we slept together.
I have one other screw up that I did, and it's not really programming related, but for a short time I was a engineering director. This was like tail end of the .com boom, and I was in charge of 15 programmers, and so things are ramping down, and we're doing layoffs, right? And our I don't know. The guy I reported to said, "Here's how I want us to do layoffs. You know, we need this to be a humane process. We're going to tell everyone that there have been layoffs and then call each person in one at a time and tell them whether or not they're affected by it and make sure they know they're valued and blah, 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 all this stuff." So, sounds great in theory, but in reality, it ends up with 15 people like sitting there at their desk going like, "Am I laid off or not?" Right? So I like have this terrible job of like calling people into my office and saying like, "Yeah, you're laid off. I'm sorry," you know, or "No, you have a job," you know, and like then they go out and, you know, have to like not act like jerks around the people that just were laid off. So anyhow, I finally get through all that. I'm like, that was the worst day ever, you know, and I'm just sitting at my desk and, you know, doing email and checking stuff out and whatever. And then like 2 hours later, there's this knock at the door, and this guy is like, "So am I laid off or what?" And I'd forgotten one of the guys. And what makes it worse is he was one of the layoffs. And so I had to be like, "Yeah, sorry, you are laid off. Really sorry about that." And that was like, I was like, I didn't really like being in management at all anyhow, but that was just, that kind of drove it home pretty well. It's like, you know, I have no desire to do this kind of thing. So, yeah, that was a mistake that I still, that was, I don't know, how five or six years ago, and I still think about that and just go, man, that sucks so bad. So, on that note, are we done with mistakes? Can we go on to the fun?
No, I don't think we're ever going to be done with mistakes. We're just going to keep on making them.
But let's keep them secret from here on out.
Except for Kevin, because it's a chance to show his brilliance.
That's right.
Lightning round?
Yeah.
Lightning round. Love it.
All right. So we'll get everyone's opinions on these topics. Number one is that Windows 7 is going to feature a Windows XP mode. So apparently you'll be able to start XP applications, and it'll be, I think it's an application level virtualization. You can run applications, they'll think they're in Windows XP. It's really running under Windows 7. John, is this a good thing?
I guess it's a good thing. Yeah, it is a good thing. They're using this MedV Enterprise Desktop Virtualization thing. Yeah, I think it's good if it gets people off of XP. I could go on and on about this, but it wouldn't be lightning, so I'll shut up.
Scott, is anyone actually going to use this?
Yes. Do you need more?
No, I guess not. It is a lightning round after all. Kevin says I'm all wrong. It's a full OS virtualization of XP, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding. But it's
kind of like the...
It's like virtual. It's like a cut-down version of virtual PC, basically.
Yeah, but it's kind of like the, I mean, what do they call it, streamlined or inlined version, where you don't have to see the entire OS in a window.
Right.
You just see the app you're running, right?
It has like what VMware calls Unity, what the Parallels guys called Coherence, where the app shows up as if it's a regular desktop application. And it kind of hides the fact that there's another OS running behind it.
So, I mean, it's lightning, but I have to say, I like the idea. I think it's good in that, you know, it moves people off things, but it's still like a cheesy lie in that, you know, like you are running an entire instance of XP, you know? And so you do have somebody wrote an article about this and said, you know, that there's some problems with it. And a bunch of people said, oh, tech analysts are idiots. They don't understand. But I think that they were right. For instance, your XP instance can get viruses and does need to be updated. And your XP instance, you know, does need servicing. And I still, like, I'm not sure how things work if you've got two XP applications that need two different XP instances and stuff like that. So, I mean, I think it's good, and it's great if it gets people off of XP. But it is kind of like one of those web formsy, cheesy lie things that, you know, the abstraction deal. I'm sorry. I just had to say it.
I mean, I do think, I think the people who will benefit the most from this are the people who have these crappy old applications where they don't have the source anymore. You know, these things are built 10 years ago and somebody lost the source, but they run their frickin' business on this stuff. Or, you know, some point of sale system or, you know, where just getting a new version isn't necessarily an option. And for those people, I think it will be very helpful. It's a little disappointing to me that it's actually only on Win 7 Professional, not the Windows Home Edition. Because I know, for example, my sister, you know, has all these old games that she gets for her kids that just don't run on Vista. And she could actually use this to, you know, run her crappy old games. I mean, these are not like, you know, Doom. It's not like running in a virtual environment isn't really a problem for a 5-year-old kid's game. But so I think everybody should have access to it. I don't think it should just be a professional thing.
I think lots of people with older games and older, like, software for the kids are going to use it.
If they could.
If they can discern the matrix that is the Windows 7 licensing scheme to figure out which version they need to buy that has it.
One other comment about the patching thing. One thing that this is kind of interesting about this is, you know, in theory, Microsoft can obsolete XP at some point and not provide security patches anymore. I wonder if this will now sort of lengthen the total lifespan of XP, where they're just going to have to provide patches forever, essentially, because they're making it available, you know, on quote-unquote new machines.
That's a good point.
That's serious. But moving on, Vista SP2 has apparently been signed off, so it's going to be available pretty soon. It's into duplication, moving towards distribution. Who thinks
it's
SP2
already on the torrents?
Yeah, it was actually on the torrents last week, I think. No, I don't know. But I don't know. Is anyone excited about SP2? Anyone know anything great that's in SP2?
At least for Server 2008, I think it adds a Bluetooth stack.
Yeah.
So those of us that were trying to use Server 2008 as a development desktop finally get to add their Bluetooth keyboards or, I don't know, sync their contacts over with their phone.
John, surely you've been running the beta of SB2 this whole time.
Yeah, I haven't, actually. And you know,
what?
I have to say it's pretty boring from what I've read about it. Like, I think I may have tested it on one computer, I'm not sure, but you know, it's stuff like, yeah, you can record Blu-ray discs, and Media Center has better content protection for protected content. And, you know, yeah, and better Wi-Fi performance when exiting sleep mode. So my lightning round input is that I think it's kind of a boring, you know, it's a service pack. It's a bunch of, like, little tiny releases, and the excitement is going into Windows 7, which is as it should be. Like, we should have, you know, boring service packs that just kind of, you know, come out. Nobody really cares because the next big Windows is coming out, not in 5 years, but in 2 years or whatever, you know. So that's – but, yeah, I was kind of like, what? There's service pack too? And then I read the list, and I was kind of like, well, don't really need any of this stuff that much.
One thing that sounds interesting, but I haven't seen it yet, is there's apparently a new, easier-to-use Wi-Fi management system, you know, for connecting to Wi-Fi networks and managing your Wi-Fi connections, which, you know, in theory is a good thing, but I haven't seen it to know if it's actually an improvement.
Wow. Sounds exciting. Who picked this for the lightning round topic? I'm getting punchy. All right. But a more exciting Service Pack 2 would be Service Pack 2 for Office. I was reading through the release notes just the other day, and it's funny. I got to the Outlook section, and it was like all the fixes that they applied to Outlook. And if you scan through that list, it's like every fourth or fifth sentence ends with, made the UI become unresponsive. So right. Apparently they fixed a lot of those performance issues in Outlook. And I've been running it now for a little over a day, and I think it might be a little faster. I haven't seen a big difference, to be honest. But has anyone else tried it out?
I haven't.
Bueller?
You know, to be honest, I haven't really been running much Office stuff lately. I got so sick of Outlook. I mean, I use Word, and I use Excel and PowerPoint, but I just kind of pop into them, edit, and get out. And I stopped running Outlook back in September because I was just done with it. It used up an entire computer, you know, and I couldn't really – it's that whole thing, made the computer unresponsive. So I may give this a shot and see, but I think I've just kind of transitioned to the – like I use Gmail and Outlook Web, and I'm kind of happy not to depend on Outlook anymore. So –
is it Outlook's fault, or is it the 50,000 beta components that are, you know, installed on your machine that are interacting in an unexpected way that cause Outlook to be See, there's the Microsoft line that says, you know, all this crap you're installing, all this third-party stuff is what's bringing down Outlook. Otherwise, it would work fine.
Yeah, I don't agree with that because I don't run – I mean, I've run Outlook with no other add-ins. And I'll bring up, like, when my computer's unresponsive, I'll look at Task Manager and see, like, all the CPU or all the memory is going to Outlook. And I've heard, you know, the stories about people dig into all the threads that Outlook spins up constantly, you know, all these background threads, 50, 60, 100 background threads, you know. And I just think there's – and to be honest, my email strategy is I just leave everything in my inbox and I search. And it works great in Gmail, and it works great in Outlook Web, and it doesn't work at all in Outlook because Outlook uses, I don't know, what that Access, you know? And, I mean, the back-end database for Outlook is just not – it doesn't keep up, whereas all the web-based versions do. So maybe, you know, if I deleted all my emails and, you know, compacted or whatever, got rid of everything, it wouldn't bug me. But
Am I the only person – left using Outlook?
No, I run it at work, and I was actually going to install SP2 at work today, and then Brad Wilson tweeted something today. He said, I think the Office SP2 install takes longer than the Visual Studio 2008 SP1 install. And I said, okay, I think I'll hold off on that until I'm not busy. Because last time I ran that, it took about an hour.
Interesting.
I personally, the thing that drives me the baddiest about Outlook, aside from the fact that it is just generally sucks. I mean, it's like 50 million features that I don't use, and the two features that I want, but it doesn't have. Is when, I don't know if you guys have this, but when the toast comes up, the new mail notification pops up.
Yeah.
And I go and I click on that notification to bring up the email. That thing takes, like, kills my machine and takes 30 to 40 seconds before it actually, like, shows the stupid email. And, like, I just want to know if they fixed that one thing. If they fix that one thing, I'll probably be happy. At least, you know, for a couple hours. But, I mean, stuff like that just drives me nasty about Outlook.
Yeah, that one I don't know because I turned the toast off.
That would probably be the smart thing for me to do.
I turned the toast off because I became really irritated with it, too. I'll have to turn it back on and see if that got fixed. But my install experience wasn't too bad. I started it up, and it ran in the background. It never asked any questions or, you know, any prompts after the initial license agreement crap that you have to check off. But I think it just ran for maybe 15 minutes and never asked me to shut down any programs. Just came up at the end and said, hey, you have to reboot.
I will say one thing. I've used Outlook forever, or for a long time, because I always used it at different companies. I generally like, you know, some of the things that Outlook does, the calendar management stuff. But it has been nice now that I'm using Outlook Web. I've got three computers at my desk. I've got a laptop and I've got two desktops, and so I've got one that's always got, you know, Visual Studio running, but everything else running on browsers gives me so much flexibility, because, like, if I want to reboot a computer, fine, pop up my email on another browser, on another computer, boom, I'm going, reboot, do whatever. And it's so nice when everything's in a browser. It's
You mean as long as that browser is IE, in the case of Outlook Web Access?
Well, that's true. Although you can use IE tab in Firefox. But yeah, that is a problem. That's a very frustrating problem.
Supposedly fixed in the next version of Outlook Web Access.
I sure hope so. Yeah.
All right, you gripers, you're turning this into the Glacier Round. So in other news, Microsoft released a new service this week. It's called Vine, and it's described as Twitter for emergencies. So when the local river is about to flood, you can run to your desktop and alert your neighbors. Who wants to cheer?
What's a very serious
Scott Kuhn thing?
Yes, I was looking to install it last night and see if the people who had lost power in Redmond during the storm were going to be able to tell me on Vine that they had lost power and whether or not I was going to lose power. But apparently I didn't think that through.
John, are you excited?
I'm a little excited. We don't get floods here that much. I desperately want to see a mashup where people use this with Left 4 Dead and use it in, you know, coordinating zombie attack and just fighting that, because that's a more complex problem. Because, for instance, when zombies bite other humans, they become infected. It's much more complex than just a flood scenario. So I don't know if they've done the data modeling there. Like, for instance, if I'm chatting with somebody on Microsoft Vine and they become infected as a zombie host, can I trust their input, and what can Vine do to help me with that? So I'm going to pass on this. There's data needs to be, you know, pulled together on that.
Interesting. I'm just wondering how many times a year would you face an emergency where you would run to your desktop to use Vine?
Well,
I mean, you're in California. You probably have a lot more emergencies than I do.
You know, we have no emergencies in California. People get all like, oh, you live in California. What are you going to do? Earthquakes. And it's like, everywhere, you know, we don't have hurricanes. We don't have tornadoes. We don't have, I don't know, all kinds of crazy stuff.
You know, I've been to Southern California twice in the last 10 months. I forget how long it was. But the last time there was an earthquake, like a 5.4, 5.1. And the time before that, there was a raging forest fire.
Oh, we do get fires. That's true.
Yeah, see? You have a lot more emergencies. You're just acclimated to them.
Well, I wonder about this. Like, would Microsoft Vine be helpful for something like the swine flu thing that people are all excited about? I mean, honestly, there's not enough cases, really. It's at this point, it's all just kind of like concern about what could happen. But
if people were using Vine, we'd probably know about a lot more. Because I could go on and postulate that I have the flu virus, swine flu virus, and convince my friends that they do too.
That's true.
And thus the prophecy will be self-fulfilling.
I just I'm envisioning the day when I actually need to run Vine, and I go and run the application, and it says, "Oh, new version is available. Do you want to download it?" And then you go to download, it says, "When Vine needs to reboot your machine. Is that okay?" Well, I don't know why the hell they have a thick client application.
What would really bother me would be when Viney, the Vine assistant, would pop up and say, "It looks like you're trying to report a fire. Would you like me to dial 911 to your approved office communicator phone?"
Stop, drop, and roll. All right. Didn't we get feedback this week that we're too snarky or something like that?
Yeah, too critical.
Did someone complain?
I think we've resolved that, though. I think this week we have gotten rid of all the snarkiness.
Awesome. Well, speaking of that, the next topic, it's rumored that Microsoft will come out with a smartphone codenamed Pink that's going to crush the iPhone. It's just going to kick its ass. What do you guys think? What does Kevin think? Kevin has an iPhone. Do you feel threatened? Do you feel intimidated? Can you feel Pink coming?
Oh, I think Pink is going to be the next Zune. I mean, I'm sure Apple is terrified, running for the hills.
Will Pink be able to achieve the level of success that the Spotwatch did, though?
And that whole market's kind of heating up. I mean, there's the pre that's not out yet, right? But it's gotten a lot of press.
Yes, correct. It's not out yet.
Well, I'll try and be unsnarky about this. I think that the whole idea of there's promise in a Windows mobile phone. Like, first of all, development for phones, like easy development for phones, could be really cool. There's some things that, you know, could be nice in people running a Windows desktop and, you know, .NET applications and then running the same thing on their phone or having, you know, and there are some services, like there's some live services that communicate things well between their phone and their computer. My brother uses those in his real estate business and it works well for him. But I've been like increasingly frustrated with just like where things are going with like the slow response. And I'm not sure what's up with it. Like why Windows Mobile has taken so long to recognize what people like about iPhones. And I realize I've broken out of my upbeat nature and now I'm drifting into snarkiness, but my upbeat take on this is that I'm very much hoping that this Pink is, you know, is the idea of like the reboot that we get. You know, we finally see some fruits of this kind of like wait and see, we're going to do something cool in the mobile space. And I hope that this is, you know, they take the best parts of what is in Zune and they take the best parts of, actually the Zune software is pretty nice. The way that the actual Zune works is pretty nice. I just hope that, you know, actually gets onto the phone and that their interface, you know, catches up.
From my perspective, I mean, you got to go by yesterday's weather. Like how long has Microsoft been in the mobile computing space? I mean, Pocket PC came out in, 2001? First went mobile phones in 2004, 2005? I mean, they've been in this market for a long time, and the rate of improvement has been glacial. So, you know, Apple comes in and in the space of a year and a half, like, completely owns the market. I just don't see Microsoft suddenly getting a clue, I guess. You know, best case, they come up with something that's sort of comparable, but that's not really enough. I mean, It can't just be sort of comparable. It would have to be dramatically better in order to take away all the momentum that Apple has. And because the other thing is Apple's got this huge development community now, which has always been Microsoft's strength, and Microsoft has now sort of lost that in the mobile space. So, you know, even if it's a very cool product, I just don't see it, you know, diffusing the Apple momentum.
Good point.
The smart thing that Apple's doing and that Android's doing is that they're just leveraging stuff that's already out there. Like, you know, they're using WebKit, they're using Linux, they're using BSD, they're using, like, they're not starting from scratch. And so they're able to leapfrog the legacy stuff that Windows Mobile is running on. I was running an Android thing. They have you can run Android on an HTC phone where you just copy some files onto your SD card and run a program, and it like bring, you know, and it's cool. You actually see it like booting Linux, and it like runs through the install thing, you know, like the booting thing, and then it's just like you're running Android, you know, and then you reset your phone and you're back in Windows Mobile. But it was like, it's a nice experience. It was very, you know, simple. I don't know. It was just like, it was interesting to see what Google had done so quickly, you know, without having to reinvent the wheel, just leveraging what's out there.
Huh. By the way, the other thing that drives me crazy about Windows Mobile is in Pocket PC is that you often can't upgrade your devices to the new version. Like, you know, Apple with the iPhone has been iterating. And, you know, even if you have the old phone, you get those new features. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of cases that's not true for the Windows Mobile stuff. So it's like, you know, makes it even less appealing as the platform.
Yes. It's interesting they've been able to do that with their Zune, but then the Zune's pretty tightly controlled. There's no third-party manufacturers that slap on the Zune operating system and sell a device. So it almost makes me think that maybe that's the direction they should go. Maybe that's what Pink will be. Yeah. Feel the excitement. So has anyone tried out Glimmer? This is something that got released on the visitmix.com site. It is allows you to easily create interactive elements on your web pages by harnessing the power of the jQuery library. Without having to handcraft your JavaScript code, you can use Glimmer's wizards to generate jQuery scripts for common interactive scenarios. Is that awesome or what?
Does it have drag and drop?
It has. I actually didn't install it, but I watched the video, and it has you know, all sorts of drop down lists and sliders, and looks like a very nice experience that generates jQuery code.
I haven't tried it yet.
We, you know, our team looked at it really quickly, and we're all kind of like, okay, you know, we've been using jQuery for a while, and we've kind of dug into this stuff, and especially the guy that does most of JavaScript on our project is like, doesn't want to use anything that gets in his way, you know. So, it seems like it's pretty cool if you're like getting started, and maybe it's going to generate something for you that you wouldn't have known already. I didn't see anything in the demo stuff that. You know, made me say, oh, this is going to give me something that I don't already have since I'm already using jQuery and, like, understand how things are working.
Right.
So, again, I'm a bit confused. Like, why is this an application that you install? Why is this not just, you know, a website?
Good point.
You know, I think of, like, the YUI Grid Builder app, which is, like, an interactive sort of, you know, app for building a grid layout in CSS and HTML. It's like, you know, it seems like they could have done that, something equivalent to that. It is a web framework, after all. Shouldn't it be running on the web?
Yeah, or it seemed like at least in Silverlight, if they wanted to go for the, you know, like rich development kind of thing.
Huh. I don't know. But I guess that concludes the lightning round.
Best lightning round ever.
That was a 20-minute lightning round. That's ridiculous. We have to practice.
We should have talked about the swine flu.
Yeah, I wanted to ask everybody, actually, do you think this whole thing with Google Maps conspiring to plot swine flu cases, do you think it's just, you know, the Republicans trying to instill fear in the country again. Oh, wait, there's no Republicans left. All right.
I'm under NDA. I'm not really allowed to talk about that.
Well, John, you're the closest to it down there. Are you, you know, zombie fight yet? Or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we've got the shotguns. We've got the front door barricaded. I think we'll be able to hold out for a bit. You know, I posted the thing on Twitter today where it was like I compared the fatalities in the past month of swine flu and tuberculosis. And granted, you know, swine flu is like an emerging thing and tuberculosis has been around for a millennium. But in terms of, like, I was on a phone call today with somebody that was, you know, talking about how their kid had a sneeze and they were, you know, worried about swine flu. And I was like, you're in Toronto? And, you know, like, I don't know. It just, I don't think people are putting, like, the actual, like, thinking about it in terms of, like, what are your actual risks, you know? I think that our risks as a species are threatened by a pandemic, but our actual risks of, like, me getting swine flu, because there have been, like, 2 reported cases in 7 million people in San Diego are, you know, infinitesimal.
People are pretty jumpy about it. There was a news article here today about a flight from Cancun into Baltimore, Washington International, where there were 2 gentlemen on board who had to throw up and they weren't feeling good. So when the plane landed, police and all these other people surrounded and detained everybody and took these guys and checked them out and determined they really didn't have any respiratory problems. They were just drunk on Corona and let everybody go.
Thank you for joining us this week on Herding Code. On behalf of the entire Herding Code staff, we thank you and welcome you back next week.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.